Good afternoon. It's a little bit after 1 o'clock. We're now going to open up the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. For the record, it's Wednesday, February 9th. I'm Representative Greg Smith. We have Monica Brown, our very, very competent LFL staff, and with us is Kathleen Bell. Today we're going to be discussing Senate Bill 5515, the budget for housing and community services. Welcome, Mr. Repine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to be with you. Good seeing you all. I feel kind of, this is the first time we've been in the grown-up room. We've always been in the smaller subcommittee room, so I feel like honored to be here.
Cool. Oh, sure. First we're going to turn to LFO for some...
Just a little administrative issue for the subcommittee. The agency has handed out a supplemental packet for their presentation, so the first two pages that are before you are replacement pages, and then they have an Appendix G. So just so you're following along with them when they get there, that is at each of your places.
Perfect.
To add in.
You know, it's amazing, Mr. Director, how time changes things. I remember about 10 years ago bringing forward a bill dealing with a natural resource issue to your full Ways and Means Committee, and you were gracious enough, yeah, you were gracious enough to allow a bill to be heard at the 11th hour about 3 days before the end of session. And I'll never forget, you looked at me and you said, listen, if you can get a note from somebody over on the Senate,
good lunch,
I'll run it. And we got the note, you kept your word, and that was actually the very first time I'd ever met you.
Now you make me feel old, Mr. Chairman. Senator Johnson, you feeling better?
Bright of eye, bushy of tail.
Okay. Well, last time I,
and right back.
Last time I talked to you on the phone, you were...
I was covering your desk door.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, again, for the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I want to go ahead and just make a declaration that most of the people, if not all the people in the room, are my staff people. So,
and or some of them aren't claiming you.
Only those. The color coordinated group over there is part of my staff. They all got the memo what they're supposed to wear today. And then we're the dark side over here in this.
I see. Okay.
Actually, why you see as many of my staff members here? When I make the presentations for this agency, I've always preferred to do the introduction and let my administrators talk about the specific areas of their specialty or expertise. So I think for the perspective of getting the best information to you, instead of having me drone on for 2 hours, it would be, I think it's more beneficial for you to hear from the administrators who work those programs day to day. So again, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, and I will present to you, you have in front of you a sheet that's kind of a short format of the discussion that we're going to deal with today on Senate Bill 5515. As it states, I'm going to deal with the agency overview in a couple of areas, along with my deputy, Jack Kinney, who sits to the right of me. And below that, program overviews, as I mentioned before, will be addressed by those particular topics by the administrators of those programs. Again, in order for you to get a better snapshot of the agency's work that we currently do and what we see doing in the future. So with that in mind, I'm going to go ahead and proceed on that. You also have our I think, binder that probably you can go through with us. I'm on the picture that has my high school picture. Actually, I have more hair in this picture, Senator. I don't know what happened.
You know, what's really troubling me is the glare off your forehead is hitting the glare off of my forehead.
Okay. Well, okay. Okay. Again, starting on page 3, I'm going to basically just touch on points that are in the text. You can read it for yourself, obviously, for its full context. But again, the agency mission, I think, is important. We, like many state agencies, have adopted a very global mission on behalf of the agency to cover what we believe is our message and our mission on behalf of the state of Oregon. So we have in our mission statement and on all our business cards have the statement, reach out for opportunities to create partnerships that improve Oregonians' lives and the quality of our communities. And so in all the elements of the work that our agency does, that is our main focus and emphasis, to meet those criteria of creating partnerships and improving Oregonians' lives and in their community, in the quality of their communities. Again, as the director of the agency and or the, as the agency itself with the state of Oregon, we are a finance agency and the community service program administrators for the state. We have finance programs for both single-family homes, new construction and rehabilitation of multifamily programs and housing developments. The agency also administers grants and tax credit programs to promote affordable housing in many and many community service programs, including federal and state anti-poverty, homeless, and energy assistance programs. Just from a standpoint of history, the agency is a relatively young agency within these, in the context of the state of Oregon. The agency was actually two agencies at one time. It was the State Community Services Department, which was then located with the Department of Human Services, and then it was then called the Oregon Housing Division. It was formulated and put into statute in 1971, the Oregon Housing Division, and then in 1991, the two agencies were combined to create now what is the Department of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And I think the reason was at that point in time, and the logic was at the 91, was there was a very identifiable link between the aspects of what we were doing in the housing elements for Oregonians and linking those other service components that seemed to be natural fits within services that we afford to people who are in our housing programs and our partners that we have currently in the state of Oregon and the services that they choose and wish to offer to their community partners. We work closely with all local levels of partners. The department is streamlined itself to be able to deliver resources as a more effective and more efficient way. And we believe and we have chosen the model of a healthy, viable community as a way to facilitate a better quality of life for all Oregonians. And once again, that is our mission and our commitment to the people of Oregon. Just to give you on page four, give you how we are set up within the statutes and how we operate, I do have, or we have, a housing council that participates with the agency on a monthly basis in approving loans and setting and developing policies that would both stimulate and increase the supply of affordable housing to low and moderate families around the state. The council advises the governor or the legislative members, state agencies, and local governments, and also works as a sounding board for my agency for policy discussions, so that in having those discussions in concert, we do and propose legislative changes or modifications to reflect policies that the council might be considering. Again, the council was created in 1971, so you can see, once again, it's only a little over 30-year standing organization, and all council members are appointed by the governor, and they go through a confirmation process, and we strive very aggressively to make sure we have economic diverse members, geographical diverse members, ethnic diverse members, so we can represent the best of Oregon at any moment in time.
Really quick, Director Refine, two questions. How many members are on the council?
We have seven.
Seven. And you mentioned that they review loans. Do they approve loans?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chairman, committee members, they have a statutory responsibility to approve loans that are over $100,000 and single-family loans that are at $150,000. So they play a, particularly in all the programs such as the Oregon Trust Account, the federal tax credits, and state tax credit programs.
So they serve as the loan committee.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just to qualify that, they serve as an approving body. We have a finance committee that reviews, an internal finance committee that's made up of the administrators and myself, that will do the more deep looking, searching of the
sure.
finance reviews to make recommendations to the council for consideration.
Sure. But just so I'm clear, though, the final lies with the state housing council.
Correct.
Thank you.
Again, the council, and you see on page 4, also has its mission statement. I won't have to go into that, but they have their own mission statement, which fits very well to the policies and procedures and the mission statement for the agency. Another partner that generally is not probably as notable, but is from a statutory standing, but from a deliverable process and product, they play a significant role in our agency's success and the state of Oregon's success on dealing with issues around poverty in the state of Oregon. Those are Community Action Directors of Oregon, or an acronym would be CADO. They are private, not-for-profit organizations consisting of Oregon Community Action Agencies, Oregon Community Development Corporations, and other private and public agencies around the state. So they become the deliverers of both programs, service programs, and in many cases, in some cases, they also are housing partners with us. There is no one set of rules for one of these partnerships. Some of them will do everything from the service components to the housing. Some of them just choose to do housing. And some of them choose to do services because there's somebody else within their community that helps support the other aspects of those services. So they come to us in a variety of different shapes, but they play a critical part of our success in and around the state of Oregon, because they are located within local governments and local jurisdictions, and their mission is to work on anti-poverty planning and programs of the same initiative. Again, below that is a reference of their website if you want to get in more information about them. Senator, and below that, yes.
We're going to have a question here, Senator Johnson.
Yeah, not a question so much as a statement. It's not often one is afforded a public opportunity to lavish praise on your partners that are doing well, but in my experience, the community action teams are just terrific. They're real assets in the communities where they are, and many of us have used them both as guides to help constituents as well as been at the ribbon cuttings when they take responsibility for doing all sorts of good projects. So it's just a chance publicly to say, at least from my perspective, I think they do splendid work.
Thank you, Mr.
Well, you're off to a good start. You're getting lavish praise, and you've got a cheer over.
Write that down. Johnson West.
Those are our partners. Yeah. Write that down. And, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I agree with you. They are really the unsung heroes. We work behind the scenes with them in most roles, but they are really the frontline deliverers of products and opportunities for your communities to be successful. So we are very pleased with that partnership. Next is on page 5, is the organizational divisions of the agency. Won't spend a lot of time on that because it really breaks down into some obvious divisions within this type of business environment that we work in. Obviously, you have the director's office. Primarily, what makes things a little different in the director's office as compared to maybe other agency structures, that I have six individuals who are referred to as regional advisors to the director. They are commonly known as RADs. They are outposted in five locations around the state of Oregon. One is in Roseburg, one is in Bend, one is in Pendleton, one is located here in Salem, and two are located in an outpost or small office in the Portland area. Those individuals are our eyes, ears, nose, sense with the public. They are the ones who are always out in the field working on either capacity issues with our partners, working with them to identify housing needs, helping facilitate how they can come about getting those needs met. And so we have effectively six people or field agents that are really doing much of the business activities of promoting, supporting, and bringing business and housing opportunities to the agency for finance consideration.
I have a question here, Representative Richardson.
Just wondering, in the selection of locations, was there a conscious decision to exclude Southern Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Richardson, actually, no. The region is a defined area of Josephine, Jackson, Curry, Coos, and Douglas. And the office, up until the last for the last 6 years, has been located between Medford and Ashland. That person has left the agency now, and so as we found another replacement, their location was preferably to be more in the Roseburg area to live and have an office there. But this individual is in the Medford, Jackson County, Ashland, Grants Pass area almost two or three times a week. So their presence may not be in an office, but their time in the field is pretty intense within those two counties, Jackson and Josephine County.
So the decision was based on convenience for living, not for the population base for the region.
Correct. It was more of a, it was a best way to cover five regions geographically. Okay. As you would know, Representative, the coast feels somewhat the same way because we don't get to them as often, but being that Douglas County allows our person to be able to kind of loop through and go around in a, we believe, is a pretty representative equal time.
And that's pretty common. If you look at the regional development officers in economic development, they're obligated to live within their region, but they're able to live where they choose. Right. And they just put miles.
And again, Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, this has only been for the last 6 months now. If we find that that does not address the issue very well as far as getting to cover the area in a reasonable fashion, then we would address that. But so far, this individual has been able to cover all the demands that have been placed on her for that geographical area.
Thank you.
And then the only other piece that I would suggest to you that's a little different than most is we have an individual who works like seven other agencies might have or do have with the Governor's Economic Revitalization Team Office. We have a liaison that works from our agency to the governor's office to guarantee or to ensure the consistency and quality of the work that's being orchestrated from the governor's economic revitalization team. So we always have a person that's involved with that, which then utilizes those six regional people to work within the regional teams on economic revitalization efforts by those teams in the regions. Each one of my RADs are a member of either one or up to three regional teams working on economic issues on an ongoing basis also. Again, those people work for me because I believe since I'm the director of the agency, they are my eyes and ears, and it's important that they have the power and the authority of my directorship to be able to accomplish things in the field. So in all cases, that's why the structure was chosen this way. Moving down to financial management, we, as you can imagine, because of what we do in a business world for lending, for multifamily and single family, we have a very very sophisticated, very fine financial management division. It comes in four sections: administrative services section, financial operations, financial services, and debt management. Again, because of the type of business and banking business we do on an ongoing basis, this is a very critical part of the mission of the agency to make sure that funds are drawn at the right time, that accounts and business deals are closed in a professional fashion, that we meet all levels of the federal regulations and laws applicable to this type of business that we engage in. So you have to have a very keen group of people who are very financially savvy to be able to pull this off on an ongoing basis.
Director Repine?
Yes.
And you may address this in the future. When a payment is made on a loan, mm-hmm. where do those payments get mailed to?
Get billed to?
Yeah, where do they get mailed to?
Oh.
When someone makes a payment. Do they come directly to your department and then you process them?
I think so, yeah. If they are getting...
We have a contract loan service agent.
Okay. We might have I don't know if they get mailed directly to us, but we have a partnership with the contract loan servicer that takes care of that for us.
Private sector?
Yeah.
Siusla Bank, I'm hearing in the background.
What's that?
Siusla Bank.
Oh.
Siusla.
Great.
Can't say that real fast.
Man, you're on a roll.
So, again, we in all of our programs, actually, Mr. Chairman, committee members, you'll find that we have a very strong, we perform the backside part of the business deals, but we rely very heavily on our banking partners, our lending partners for all of our programs, because we can't duplicate or replicate that type of horsepower that they offer us, and so we always have a very strong working relationship with all the lenders in most of our business activities.
Senator Verger.
Yes, I wanted to thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask now, is this where you also manage your reserves? Your reserve accounts is in the financial management section?
Correct. Yes, it is.
And is there some percentage of reserves that you keep on hand, or is there a rule of thumb?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, we have, I think you'll find we're going to be presenting some information on that later in the next 2 days on reserves, and we are prepared to articulate what our reserve purposes, what our reserve amounts are, what their purposes are, or what they're intended to do, so you can have a pretty good understanding of what those requirements are, either direct or indirect requirements for reserve allocations. And then it'll show you what one could arguably say may be something that's over excess of either federal or state requirements.
Follow up,
please.
And those you'll be explaining this, I know, but those requirements are followed by the Financial Management Division. In other words, they know which requirements there are, and so they are obliged to those. Those. All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
The one thing I want to point out to the committee is I think I am going to have to exercise a little discipline and keep us moving forward because we have 2 days. And so what I'm going to ask is that we keep all of our questions, and I'll keep my questions as well towards the end, and then we'll ask them then, unless there's something pressing that needs to be asked, as we have 2 days and a lot of information.
And, Mr. Chairman, what we will do in turn is if the questions do come up or we hear about those, we'll obviously try to integrate those in our program in the next, in today and tomorrow.
Perfect. And like I've shared with the committee, if need be and we need to have additional time, Mr. Repine has agreed to meet with us individually or as a small group without a quorum to address any issues we may have.
Okay. So, again, there's four sections in our financial management, and, again, they're described here in this little check in this paragraph. Next one is the Information Systems Division, again, more the technology side of the agency. The division has established an enhanced and centralized information resource system. We are the keeper or stewards of much information because of many of our community service programs, which are federal programs, which require accountability and direct reporting on results. So we've gone to designing and having in place very sophisticated reporting tools that can collect the data in a very effective way without having people to make entries, to re-enter into paper, to make another electronic entry, so that when it's done, it can be done once and then sent into our agency, and the information then can be distilled or put into a data profile on general information around the state on many, if not most, of our programs. Asset property management, this is one that sometimes people have a tendency to forget about, but this is a very huge piece of our business activity. Because we manage or we have investments in literally thousands, tens of thousands of properties, over 200 units, which house over 25,000 people in the state of Oregon, in the terms and conditions of the finance tools or funding tools we use, our partners who are participating in the purchase of bonds to fund these programs expect a certain level of product control over the term of the mortgages. And with that in mind, we have a staff of individuals who are involved with yearly monitoring of all of our units to make sure that the units are meeting a satisfactory level of care and maintenance, making sure that the people are living in what was promised to them when they initially moved in, and addressing any kind of problems that might have arisen from tenants not being getting the proper type of housing which they've been led to believe they'd be receiving. They also check with the property owners and or managers on financial statements. They check for insurance. They do the ongoing, just to make sure that the paperwork that is in place, meeting federal requirements for information regarding income eligibility on certain programs might be a topic, are in files and are filed accurately. So this group spends an enormous amount of time during the course of the year visiting many of our programs. We try to do it, in some cases, on an annual basis on some of the programs. If not that, probably down to about 2 to 3 years that each project does get visited. So it's a very important part to maintain the quality and the integrity of our loan portfolio for the purpose of the loans that we have guaranteed with bondholders. On page 6, we have a Community Resource Division. This is the part of our business that deals more with the ongoing relationship with your local partners and community partners. This is the organization that spends an enormous amount of time doing FaceTime with the CAP organizations, Community Action Partners organizations, the Community Development Corporation partners, a variety of those people who deliver services on behalf of people of low income or people who are suffering from homelessness or displacement in their communities or who have hunger issues. This is the part of our agency who deals with those type of services in and around the state, working hand-in-hand with the food banks and food pantries and other local community partners in delivering services. This also is the place where we house or have our Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Resolution Program, which used to be called the Manufactured Housing Ombudsman Program from last session, where we deal with, represent, and work with residents and tenants to so they can understand what their legal rights are as when they have problems or issues with their landlords or park managers. And so we have people who will work with those individuals one-on-one to help resolve or make an attempt to resolve those issues. Another growing part of this section is the Energy Department. Many of you had been around here years past where Senate Bill 1149 was instituted by the state of Oregon, which has allowed for a certain amount of money to be passed to this our agency for energy and weatherization programs, along with already existing weatherization programs that we've had, coupled with a couple of legal cases of settlements from other states that we were the recipient of some dollars that came from those settlements for overcharging from some lawsuits in Texas. But those monies all flow through our energy department so we can improve or share these resources with people who either have energy bills that they can't pay, so they could be given an opportunity to have a supplement bill payment, to look at their dwellings to see if they are energy efficient, to see if they can be improved either with weatherization aspects or insulation, to try to help engage with our partners to maybe teach individuals how to be better stewards of their energy bills so they don't turn on the heater and open the window and don't understand why their electric bill is $100. So it's been a very growing, active part of our agency and seems to be because of what we're seeing in energy costs and rising energy costs and fuel issues will probably play a very predominant role in the time to come.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator Johnson?
I don't want to discuss it now, but I'd like the professional staff to flag it as a point to get into later, is just exactly how you interact with the Energy Trust and what kinds of fiscal support they're giving initiatives within the housing.
Okay. That very well could come up under Ms. Ron as a presentation. And also we have in this section, you'll hear about this a little bit later, we have the Oregon Commission on Volunteer Action and Services, which is a organization that works with federal programs for VISTA volunteers and AmeriCorps volunteers. They joined our agency a couple of sessions back to keep delivering the services that they currently do, where they make those VISTA volunteers and AmeriCorps volunteers available to communities around the state of Oregon for working them as usually their grad students or college students who want to spend community time practicing either planning or helping with local community issues. And so they it's a program that fits well with the divisions and our agency's mission. And finally, we have the Housing Division. Again, this by its title is probably more obvious than any of them. This is where we have our multifamily programs and our single-family programs. Again, their mission is to use all available resources to the maximum available for high-quality, affordable housing for low- and moderate-income families around the state of Oregon. The housing section includes the housing resource section, which deals with the tax and grant programs that we administer for both the state and the federal government. And primarily, these are subsidy programs that are used to, at the end of the day, create lower rents for Oregonians on a continual basis, and those rates to be much lower than generally local market rates are.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, again, not to discuss now, but the flag, there were three of us that were together in a hearing this morning discussing an elderly rental assistance program now housed at Revenue. And the question about whether or not, given that the Revenue has offered it up on its reduction list, whether or not that program could find a home in your agency, and I think that I raise it with the permission of the chair right now because all of us were concerned about a program that obviously assists a certain segment of the population desperately in need of help, given a low priority in revenue, given the mix of their portfolio, and I'm not saying this in a pejorative sense, but just it's not core to their business. But when you come back in the second phase to have maybe had a thoughtful discussion with revenue to see if that program could find another home, and this was a chance at least to put you and the professional staff on notice, it's something that several of us want to talk about.
Sure. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to follow up on Senator Johnson's statement, to add to that, are there federal funds that we can use to displace the general funds, because this project is 100% general fund, $9 million. And can we cut back and match? Are there matching funds where we could actually have some general fund savings? So I just wanted to add that to the agenda.
What I was going to suggest was that Senator Johnson and I and Director Refine and the folks from Revenue and then LFO, we all get together and just have a meeting, and I'd open it up to any of you that would like to attend as well, and let's just sit down, because I think there's some challenges, but we ought to at least have a discussion.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, prior to coming here about 2 weeks ago, we actually had a preliminary meeting with the Department of Revenue about this discussion or this issue that you've raised, and we were there with the Department of Human Services because they felt between the two of us, we were probably the more likely natural partners that could utilize or offer the same kind of services that that program currently is offering Oregonians. So we went back, as Department of Human Services has done, I suspect, and kind of looked at all of our programs to figure out if we were to have something like that, what could it marry up to enhance an existing program as opposed to starting something new, and or to what degree the leveraging could come about from other programs that we have that would leverage the greatest amount of money, other funds, for maybe the same amount of a reduced amount of general funds. So we're looking at that. With at this point in time, I've talked to the chair on that as of this morning, actually.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm almost done, so bear with me. Organizational chart, again, it really is on the next page, page 7. You'll just see it really is a... It is more of the typical organizational structure that really is reflected in the comments I made before, where, as the director, I have answering I have the council on one side of me and direct communications with CATO, Community Action Directors Organization, as far as policy and services that are needed around the state. And below, you'll find the other agencies that make up, entail the rest of the department. Page 8 is long-term objectives. Again, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but as far as the agency goes, we have spent a considerable amount of time on this, trying to make sure that we are meeting the obligations of what we see as our 10-year plan based on observations or direction from the Legislative Assembly over time, and how those are being addressed and how they affect and relate to the benchmarks, Oregon benchmarks. And so below you will find a series of 5 long-term objectives that we've established. This is our 5-6-year plan. They are broad in topic, so they don't mine down necessarily to the absolute how do you get there, but that comes about through another process that we have. But again, these are our long-term objectives on being becoming a high-performing agency, which is all an internal process. How do we come the best we can be on behalf of citizens?
Mr. Chair, if I promise this is the last one.
Senator Johnson, your questions are so good you can ask me.
We had this discussion in another committee as well, whether or not you engage any stakeholder groups or any external, particularly given the vast array of partners that you work with, whether or not there's any place for those folks to come to the table with you and look at your long-term objectives and goals. I think sometimes when agencies plan only internally, they don't reap the bountiful benefit of their partners and the people they're serving to get those folks' impression of whether or not you really have developed strategies and objectives that are in synchronous with external folks you work with. Do you have outside stakeholder input?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, to the degree you're talking about, probably not, but we do have an ongoing, as we develop our goals that we have for our strategic plan, that we have, which is more the piece that mines down to these more specific levels. We have those documents, and we have discussions with our partners, the partners that we do business with on an ongoing basis, so they see what our goals and objectives are, so they can react to them or push back to try to see if we've hit the mark correctly. Again, generally, the long-term agency goals are set within the agency, but again, they are very high level to the extent where I don't think anybody would find that having it being a high-performing agency would not be a good thing for the agency to be. Increasing the building capacity in community programs would be an obvious. So it really is when we drop down to the next strategic level for what we call as our two-year plan or strategic plan is where we then have that more of a face-to-face discussion with our partners.
Just as a follow-up, I can't help but look at you and not see Mrs. Lowe over your shoulder, knowing that she is as knowledgeable about this budget as just about anybody else, and her definition of becoming a high-performing agency might be slightly nuanced from the guys that actually sit in the agency every day. And it's my opinion that commingling of those perspectives is in the long term valuable, particularly in the aspect of customer service.
I wouldn't disagree with you. Again, so we have the long term objectives and how they relate to the benchmarks, which is again as a measuring tool that agencies are subjected to make sure that we're meeting the goals and the vision of the Oregon benchmarks. So again, you'll see those, and the benchmarks are listed along with those. The other piece I wanted to visit with you just a little bit about was it's on would be in the back. It's a little out of order here, so I apologize for that. If you go to tab G in the back, it'll be the last one in your book. It is not tab G. There is no tab G.
Page number.
It's the one that you would have.
Page
F.
Number.
Is it tab F? Well, it was tab F in mine, but I was told it was going to be tab G.
Oh, right.
It would be this nice, in the back of your book, colored chart.
Okay.
Somewhere near the back.
It's appendix F.
Okay. It's in F in mine, but I was told it was going to go to G.
It'd be
so
page 89.
Again, quickly, as you'll see as you hear the rest of the discussion from the administrators, this is kind of a bar chart or an example of how this agency functions as it relates to its long-term objectives, which are highlighted in the red, how it relates to its performance measurements that are those from the Oregon benchmark. And then below in the yellow is that two-year strategic plan that I was mentioning, and how these all kind of fit together to fulfill a mission, like baseline missions for short-term goals fit into components of the performance measures, which then have identifiable tracks up to the long-term objectives. And so this is the agency's effort that we've been working on for some years to make sure that there's continuity between what we're looking at the top and what we're doing day-to-day in our activities. And so that there is no disconnect. We want to make sure that our efforts that we're making on a day-to-day effort are addressing those things that we've defined or decided to be strategic goal missions that directly relate to outcome measurements that address the benchmarks, which then also in turn complement and support our long-term objectives. And so that's kind of an easy visual way to see how that process is. We've developed it in the agency. And then finally, I was going to just add to you, if you turn to Appendix D, another activity, and I talked about it briefly, is our involvement with both my field representatives, the six individuals who are around the state, and also with the person who is liaisons to from our agency to the governor's economic revitalization team. This I share with you because I'm very proud of what has been accomplished, at least on our in the team's work around the state. Many of you know that have been around, knowing that when it first started, it had some of its major questions of why are you doing this and why can't you do this in a different way. I think the results that I want to share with you in the attached pages on 62 and 63 are really some great roles that we're helping with. And as you know, that the governor's economic revitalization team, along with economic community development, has been working on certifying industrial sites around the state. And one on the surface would say, well, what does housing care about there? But what this has actually done for us, and I think it's a very positive event, has allowed us to say, you know, what we offer you, what we should be offering you, is this profiling of what does your community have in the way of your current housing relative to what these industrial parks might bring you when a business comes. Mm-hmm. To have raw land for the purpose of bringing an industrial business there is important. But if, in fact, your housing stock is either deficient or not existing at all, and which means that somebody might have to drive 20 miles or 40 miles or 50 miles to live, to work, doesn't really address the overall issue that the community is going to be faced with. You want an industrial relationship and business there, but at the same time, it would be nice to know that you have a balance with housing. So our effort in this particular joint effort with the governor's economic revitalization team was to prepare this inventory of housing stocks for each of these communities as they've been certified. And so this is just but one activity that we play. We play every day or every week in the state of Oregon where there's regional teams working on community issues to try to resolve, though. We have, as the other agencies from the governor's economic revitalization team have done, have figured out where we can be a strong stakeholder at that table to help, not necessarily push or persuade or prod, but to assist communities to better understand their issues around their housing, so it would be better in the discussion on either industrial lands or growth or planning will be more in tune with what are the real needs within the economic structure of that community.
On where it shows rental units,
mm-hmm.
and across, are those dollar values?
Yes.
So then can we assume that the 0 to 199, are those traditionally subsidized units?
They could be. I don't think break them down separately. This is all from, just so you know, that, Mr. Chairman, this comes from the 2000 census basis, and I'm not that familiar if it includes subsidy in there, but I'm assuming it's just questions if you rent, or is your rent between $0 and $199, which probably doesn't ask a secondary question, may not ask a secondary question, are you getting subsidy?
Well, the reason I ask that is that then if you go down further, it says estimated imbalance minus 70. I assume we're not encouraging development of $99 apartments.
No. Well, again, if you're going to get a full shot, I mean, Mr. Chairman, committee members, why we do this, even though we're not either encouraging to build 70 more units that would be renting for $200 a month, but it's important to know a full snapshot of your housing inventory in your community. When you drive by people, when you see houses, you don't know exactly what they're renting for, but you mentally add those in your housing inventory.
Got it.
And so it's good to be able to say, of the houses that we have, they are in these categories, and there are abundance of them that are available here, or there's a lacking of them of affordability there.
Okay.
But again, because this is off the census information, my suspicion is that the census asks questions all the way from zero to all the way up to above $1,200.
Thank you.
One question.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Epine, it's good to see you, and my apologies, other committee work is calling me, but tell me how you're doing. When you look in an area like Portland with 98% occupancy rate, and how are you doing with housing for the mentally ill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
And it was going so well.
I'm sorry. Would you rather report that the next time?
No, actually, well, we can actually give you a report of that, Senator. But we have, in the last, six to seven years, one of the issues that we've been trying to do is try to really reach out to populations that we define or describe as our special needs populations.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be everybody, anybody from seniors to could be farm worker housing. It could involve chronically mental ill people, mm-hmm. people with disabilities, a variety of people other than maybe just general low-income families. And along with our programs that we have and some other complementary programs that have come to us from Department of Human Services, where they extend some resources to use resources to match some of our funding programs, we've been able to actually create, over 1,100 units in a very short period of time with chronically mentally ill for mental health housing. Now, as Mr. Chairman and the members of the committee will know, what happens when you are in that environment, when you're working there, first of all, you can, the amount of money that comes in from those residents, which is generally from their SSI or benefits, is very minimal. And it doesn't even cover the probably if you collect it at all, it covers the operational cost of the entity for housing them. So it requires a lot of resources, a lot of deep skewing of programs to make sure that we get make it so that whatever the rents are will be from 0 to 30% median income, because there isn't enough cash flow from the rent that comes in to help make it a very profitable. So it doesn't, the building or the development cannot support much debt. Now, the building's going to cost just as much as if it was supporting having housing people at 60% median income, quite frankly. But the reality is that income isn't there, so you need to put a lot more resources with it to accomplish this. So we have, just to highlight a couple of things we've done here in this last year. As you all know, Damish has been under conversion to a program called Villa Bois up in the Wilsonville area. Last session, I think this body approved the sale of the Damish property with an 8-acre set-aside for mental health housing. We have been working with Villa Bois and the general partners and the mental health partners in that community, making sure we have money set aside to address those parcels of land that will be eventually available for mental health housing. From what I understand, when it's all built out, when you have 8 acres, it will eventually build out with over 240 people who have some incapacity dealing with mental health who will be able to live now in the Villa Bois community, kind of bringing back the people who were either directly or indirectly related with the damaged facilities at one time. So we make every effort to try to make those links with those special needs populations because, A, they are the most vulnerable, and if we can keep them in housing that keeps them either stable or on their meds, we also find that it's a tremendous value added to the state of Oregon so they aren't put in institutional programs and or hospitalized.
Follow-up question. Have we received any federal dollars in the last 2 years regarding housing for the mentally ill?
I'm going to, Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I'm going to turn over to my right shoulder and look at Mr. Krager.
He's shaking his head.
He said, and he's saying, with a shake of his head, no.
Okay. With all the, with the kind of technical assistance you have in your office, have you guys tried to look around and see how you can look for grants that would help this group? I mean, we just got to do something in our state to maintain the dignity of people once they become mentally ill. I mean, I'm seeing too many people walking around with no place to stay or going to jail, and their greatest crime is that they are mentally ill. And so I'm wondering, you know, if it ever comes across your desk, opportunities with grants and other things to apply for housing for the mentally ill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, we are always eager to find out or find grant opportunities either from our agency or from partners letting us know that they might be available. I actually just yesterday had a meeting with Commissioner Nadeau talking about this very issue with her in my office and some of the programs and some of the ideas that she's coming up with on how to maybe start addressing those in the Multnomah County area.
Right.
So I think what I'm seeing generally is a lot more interest both from the public entities and communities, and actually I'm seeing a lot of interest from the community corrections people. I've been involved with a program called Partners in Crisis, which deal with people who are incarcerated because of their mental health issues, not because of some other criminal issues in their life. So those groups have been getting together, they have a couple pieces of legislation in here to start changing maybe the deliverables and the methodologies that we deal with mental health people. My staff and I have been working with Director of Corrections Williams on how we can help prevail or help him with clients that he has behind the wall that have mental health issues, and that's why they're in residence there, not necessarily in healthcare environments. So we're reaching out. I think there seems to be a growing interest because the number is becoming even disproportionately greater than most people have believed at any time.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Director, I'd like to just let you know as you plan your time that we're going to need about an hour and a half tomorrow to review priorities and those issues, and so however you'd like to spend the time. We have another hour and 10 minutes.
Okay,
and
well,
half an hour tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate that. That's a great segue for me to be quiet and to move on into Mr. Kenny will, and I was going to tee him up. Sometimes I don't have to have...
Mr. Chairman, before you leave, Senator Morris.
This is a very simple question. The chart that you showed us.
Yes.
Could you, Mr. Chairman, I don't know what it means. I don't know how to read it. So if
well,
we could...
I will...
he's not alone.
Okay, we will. I'll tell you what, Mr. Chairman, senators, and other members of the committee, I will make sure that Richard B. Allen, who is the person who puts that together, will give me a 5-minute educational opportunity on that tomorrow.
So okay, that'd be good, because I just don't know what it means.
Yeah, we'll do it.
We'll get somebody.
Well, we'll get somebody. If he's not here, we'll get somebody. Okay, I was going to tee up Mr. Kenny, but sometimes, you know, less words is better off, and so here's Mr. Kenny.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jack Kenny, Deputy Director, Oregon Housing and Community Services, and I'll take the cue from Representative Richardson and be brief. I'm going to touch briefly on environmental factors and then introduce Gina Rana and Bob Gillespie, who are the administrators for the Community Resources and Housing Divisions, respectively. This was touched on, but I think before I get into the specific environmental factors, I'd like to just reiterate that we do not deliver services directly ourselves. We work through a variety of community action partners. For example, we do not make loans to first-time home buyers, banks, and lending institutions do that. We do not own apartment buildings or group homes, community development corporations, housing authorities, private sector landlords own the buildings, and we don't case manage people who need energy assistance or homeless assistance, emergency food assistance. That's done through community action agencies, and that's already been talked about. So having said that...
Let me ask a question on that just really quick. So then when you're funding a project and you use one of those other entities as an intermediary, let's say you're going to do a loan. Okay. Would you loan the money to the intermediary who then relends it? Or do they just serve as a servicing agent on a credit?
If it's the first-time home buyer, someone who's buying their first residential home, then the bank or the lending institution will make the loan, and we will purchase the loan from the bank. If it's it's a loan for an apartment building,
right,
we typically make the loan ourselves. So we sell bonds, take the proceeds from the bonds, and lend them.
Okay.
So what do we do for those community action partners? We can do, obviously, if there's federal or state money coming to those entities, there are strings attached to them. One of our roles is compliance, ensure that the correct target population is being served. Got it. We also we make sure that best practices are being followed, conflict of interests, things like that aren't occurring, that... we provide, where we can, with economies of scale, we can perhaps produce a computer system, for example, that would facilitate their federal reporting requirements and allow them to communicate with subrecipients using web-based computer systems and things like that. And we can do that more efficiently at the central level. We also, this provides some challenges in some cases for something. The idea of having our service delivery through community action partners is that those people in the community know best what their community needs are, as opposed to us in Salem. So within parameters, they can set the priorities. They can decide who they're going to serve. So if our performance measure, and this will be a segue, instead of doing our performance measures all at the end of the session, we're going to have Bob Gillespie and Jeannie Arana talk about the service measures relative to their programs during their presentation. So we may set a performance measure that is for senior housing. And if that community says we have a greater need for single parents with children, we have some challenges there. So we try to develop our service performance measures in a way that will flexible enough to address those types of things. There are significant consequences for noncompliance, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But obviously, when you're issuing tax-exempt bonds, or there's literally tens of millions of dollars that come to the state annually in tax credits, those developers who get those tax credits are banking on being able to get the credit at the end of the day when they file their taxes, so we have to ensure that the compliance is there. Similarly, when you're issuing bonds, the financial community, there's disclosure requirements relative to that, and again, the program has to be serving the need that it's intended for. So we do that compliance work. We provide training and technical assistance. There's a lot of questions that will be the same throughout our service delivery function, so if there's legal opinions that need to be obtained, we can do that work and make sure that we're all operating from the same page. Again, I'll hurry through part of this. On the other hand, there are statewide needs that perhaps that a community has that they may not recognize. I think some of the charts that some of the research that we do, some programs perhaps there isn't capacity within a community to do that. So there are times when we'll take discretionary funds or we'll set aside funds through an RFP process to make sure that community unmet needs are addressed or that appropriate service delivery mechanisms are developed within a community. Again, I think in the interest of time, I'll kind of pass through the rest of my remarks quickly. I do want to talk a little bit about the environmental factors so you have some context for the service delivery that in the areas that our mission addresses. Home ownership affordability, Oregon is one of the lowest in the nation in home ownership affordability. Our home ownership rate is 42nd in the nation. We were during the 90s, we had the largest increase in housing prices nationally. Our first-time home buyer program can put a small dent in that, but obviously that's a huge problem based on housing prices. Rental housing, I should distinguish between our programs and those of the housing authorities. The subsidized housing that's talked about is primarily delivered through the housing authorities. They are the biggest game in town as far as delivering affordable housing. And for a housing authority program, residents typically pay what they can afford to pay based on their income level. The housing that we develop typically has a restricted rent level, a capped rent. So some people that live in our housing may still be rent burdened. They may still be making a lower income than is typically optimal. But in any case, the rents are restricted. So those are the two big games in town, I guess, if you will, for affordable housing. One is the housing authorities and rent based on income level, and then the tax credits and the grants that we provide where the rents are restricted so they will be affordable to people at particular income levels. Energy prices are increasing dramatically, 33% increases from 1990 to 2003. That puts a burden on people. Rent prices, we are 45% of the population in Oregon is considered rent cost burden for rent. I think those types of costs are driving things like hunger rates in Oregon, which I think we've been in the top five in hunger in the nation. We are taking steps to address that, not sitting back. The governor has a five-year plan to end hunger in Oregon. We've been instrumental in that. I know Bob and Jeannie have been leaders in that from the state level. Some of Jeannie's staff have also gone to the federal government, kind of getting to the earlier questions, and increased. We used to have only one county that was served by the Commodity Supplemental Food Program. We've now increased that to six counties. We basically did the Chinese water torture test on the federal government, repeatedly asking. So now we have a center in Pendleton and one in Jackson County that serves seniors with food assistance. So we're making some progress there. There are cuts in federal funding. I mentioned the housing authorities. I think they're looking at, normally they get a 3% increase. It looks like they could be getting a 2% cut in federal funds. So that's going to be an impact. And I do want to talk, I mentioned the performance measures are going to be discussed in Jeannie and Bob's presentations later. Customer service, we do have a placeholder, and I'd like to respond briefly to Senator Johnson's question. I think that was an excellent suggestion. Our customer service performance measure hasn't been addressed yet, and I think, to your point, I think involving the stakeholders systematically will be very useful to us. We do not ignore stakeholders, I would like to say that. We allocate funds through a consolidated funding cycle for housing programs, for example, and that way we can coordinate all the various different grants, tax credits, and loan programs at one time. We have had discussion groups, peer groups, to evaluate the consolidated funding cycle twice in the last 5 years, I believe.
where we've asked housing authorities, community representatives from housing authorities, community development corporations, private sector developers to come and give us feedback on our consolidated funding cycle process. We've also done that with our single-family grant program. Certainly some of the issues that were discussed were, should we be using down payment assistance or should we be using it to develop new first-time home buyer affordable housing? So we do try to get that input. Community action directors meet with Jeannie and her staff on a monthly basis, so again, we try to get that input as well. So I guess in the interest of time, I'll cut off the rest of my remarks and bring Gina Rana and Bob Gillespie to the table to talk about their program areas.
Thank you. Any questions at this point? Okay, we'll proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Jean Arana. I am the Administrator of Community Resources Division within Oregon Housing and Community Services. I would like to, before I get into a little more in-depth program information, share with you that there are many opportunities that we seek, as well as our partners seek of us, for input in our planning processes. Within the Energy and Weatherization Program, we have advisory groups that are made up of not only community action partners, but also utilities and other stakeholders. So in making policy decisions, in making allocation decisions, we do have our partners at the table when we discuss those. When we begin our strategic planning process, we invite our partners to engage in the development of our goals and how those will play out in the community. So that is very important to us. My background as an Army nurse tells me that the resources need to get out to the front lines where the services are most needed, and that has been my approach since becoming the administrator. My portion begins on page 15, and I want to talk a little bit about the energy and weatherization programs that our division administers. We have various energy and weatherization programs that do operate through not only community action agencies, but we do have other partners. We have partners among the Native American tribes, and we have an organization that serves primarily farm workers in the state of Oregon that also delivers some of our energy services and weatherization services. Our programs for assistance prevent families from having their heat shut off, and weatherization programs create energy savings for families, which translates into savings for them to be used for other needs within their household, such as food and their rent. We have several sources of funds within our energy and weatherization programs. We have a low-income weatherization program that actually has several funding streams, federal and state. And we provide that at no cost to households below 60% of Oregon's statewide median income.
Excuse me. Now, you're talking about the energy and weatherization programs?
Yes.
Okay. Would you define where the other funds are coming? What is the source for the other funds?
For the...
Yeah, I'm not sure where the other funds are coming from.
For energy and weatherization?
Right.
All right. We do have for... energy assistance, we have some federal resources called the Low-Income Energy Assistance Program. That comes to us from Health and Human Services at the federal level.
Okay, now that's separate than the federal funds. So we've got two columns. We show $37 million from other funds and federal funds of $56 million. And so I'm just wondering what goes into the category for other funds.
All right. Other funds is Senate Bill 1149 from the 1999 session established energy restructuring in the state of Oregon. A portion of that legislation created energy bill payment assistance from a meter charge in the PGE and PacifiCorp service territories. And it also created a public purpose charge that provides low-income weatherization that is administered through our agency to and through Community Action and other partners.
Okay, so I understood that the meter charge brings in part of it, but I don't know where the public purpose charge comes from. Where does that money come from?
The public purpose comes from a 3% charge on the customers of PGE and PacifiCorp.
Okay.
And those monies, public purpose money, 10% of it goes to the educational service district or school districts, service districts, and the remaining is divided among the Energy Trust Organization, which Senator Johnson referred to. And we get 13%, I believe, for low-income weatherization.
Okay, I don't mean to drill down too far. I just wanted
to
know. I got two categories, and when it says other funds, I just didn't know what that meant.
Right. So other funds is primarily the energy restructuring. Correct.
Great. Thank you.
And, of course, it is restricted to the PGE and PacifiCorp territories, service areas.
Thank you.
In addition, we have some funds from the settlements, the Williams settlement that was a result of energy overcharging in the state of California, and Oregon was a part of that settlement. And we received a one-time influx of funds for both weatherization and low-income energy assistance from the AG.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Again, our weatherization funds are both federal and state, and our low-income energy assistance programs, we have both federal and state funds for that. In addition, we have an Energy-Rated Homes of Oregon program, which is helpful in reducing mortgage costs for homeowners who want to go the route of energy efficiency. Again, our key partners are community action agencies, affordable housing developers in the use of those dollars, and we do have other partners. For the first time in the state of Oregon, all 36 counties in the state of Oregon have a community action program. We just signed the paperwork about 2 weeks ago with Harney and Malheur counties. So we do have service delivery in all 36 counties through community action, which we're very pleased with, and certainly the communities are thankful. You can note the key outputs, and I won't read those for you, but we are generating savings from the dollars that you award to us, and the federal government awards to us. And we are serving those people who are most in need of assistance through our community partners. Our community partners tell us through work plans how they want to use those dollars, which people in their community are to be served. And the boards of our partners are made up of low-income representatives and elected officials, as well as people from the community at large. And there is a large emphasis on business involvement in the community action agencies. So we believe they truly represent the needs of the community to us, and we allocate dollars in our programs accordingly. We're very proud of our performance measurement.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
On page 15, these are very specific output measurements. Total energy cost savings generated from modifications related to the department's ECHO weatherization program. In 2004, $5,648,915. How do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, there's actually a formula that is utilized to, when these measures are applied, these are the savings that can be anticipated. And that is the formula that we use when we are making decisions about weatherizing homes.
Is it an industry standard, a federal formula, your formula?
I believe it's a
the window manufacturer's formula?
I believe it is an industry standard. As well as.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chair, just as a follow up, so these numbers are theoretical, they're not actual measurements?
They are as close to actual as we can get. When we are projecting the savings, it is based on a fairly scientific formula that will tell us the savings that we will get in kilowatt hours when we use and apply these measures to a structure.
But it's pro forma, it's not actual.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
Thank you. Are there Any more questions on the outputs? We'll move on then.
I have one quick question. Where do I find the public purposes money in this? Is this the number of houses, the households receiving the energy assistance through the low income?
The public purpose dollars for low-income weatherization is that first number, the total energy cost savings generated from modifications, and the total number of dwelling units served related to the department's weatherization programs actually encompasses all of our weatherization funding streams.
Just by way of follow-up on what you said earlier, when you said that the other funds are primarily for meter charges from PG&E and others, and that they're restricted for utilization within those regions where they're generated. I don't know how large a region that is, and I'm wondering, is there then also similar benefits to other regions in the state? And if so, where does that money come from?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, the territory of PGE and PacifiCorp covers a fairly significant part of the state, and PGE and PacifiCorp are investor-owned utilities that were covered by the legislation that deregulated energy in Oregon. There are also consumer-owned utilities throughout the state that, as a part of that legislation, are required to have in place a low-income energy assistance program and report to our department. We don't administer the consumer-owned utility low-income programs. They're administered either directly by the utilities or through other partners. Some of them share our community action partners in that delivery system. There are, by law, supposed to be low-income energy assistance programs throughout the state. And the reports, we do get a report on consumer-owned utilities that I would be happy to share and bring to the committee.
Okay, that would be fine if you would.
I would like to talk a little bit about the performance measurement, which we are very proud of, and that is energy efficiency at the top of page 16. For all funds invested, the percentage of energy savings generated from the department's energy conservation helping Oregonians, which is the public purpose low-income weatherization program. When we first got the funds, we recognized that there was a need to build capacity, and I think what you're seeing there in 2003, where our goal was 100% target, and we hit 83%, that is a capacity issue because we do deliver through community organizations, and they have really risen to the charge, and in 2004 we exceeded our goal, and we are very excited about that. One of the ways that we build capacity with our partners
I'm wondering if you could tell us how you set the target.
Of 100%?
Yeah, 100% of what? I'm sorry, maybe I'm just not clear.
For the percentage of energy savings generated from the weatherization program.
Okay, you're at 118%.
Does that mean a dollar invested returns $1.18?
Correct. Savings? Correct. Our goal is a dollar per kilowatt hour savings, and we have exceeded that.
Okay. Is there a readjustment of the goal? Are you going to stay at a dollar per, or?
The dollar per kilowatt hour savings is actually a target that was developed with our partners, with our stakeholder partners.
All right. Thank you.
And I would say that I don't believe that that is necessarily the goal of other users of public purpose, that there are different goals. So this is ours, our agency's goal.
Thanks.
We do recognize that there is a huge demand for assistance, and that to continue to just provide dollars to avoid shutoff doesn't really move people to self-sufficiency, which is a goal of our department and our partners. And we have a group that's called E2C2, and it sounds very Star Wars-ish, but it stands for Energy Efficiency and Consumer Competency. And it is a group that is made up of a number of our energy partners. And they were instrumental in developing the REACH grant, the Residential Energy Assistance Challenge grant, which is federal money that really seeks to marry case management with the energy assistance dollars to educate people, to move them from a poverty and dependency situation on these dollars into a self-sufficiency situation. So we also have provided a great deal of training and technical assistance to our partners and have developed a nationally recognized weatherization certification training in the state of Oregon, and our community action partners are the recipients and participants in that training. With that, I'll move on to other programs within my division, our self-sufficiency and emergency assistance programs. There are probably three areas that are covered by the self-sufficiency and emergency assistance program. We provide rental assistance and homeless assistance and food program assistance through both our community action agency partners as well as those others I mentioned. And in addition, the regional food banks are in partnership with our department. Some of the food banks are within the community action agency. Some are standalone, but we partner with them, again, through the Oregon Food Bank out of Portland. The department administers five programs that provide monthly rent subsidy payments for low-income families and individuals. We do also provide two programs that provide rental assistance for those people with HIV and AIDS. One of those grants is in partnership with the Department of Human Services and the Ryan White Case Management Program. The other is our own grant that we actually have partnered with the funds that come from DHS, and that is for people coming out of prison who have HIV and AIDS and locating housing in the communities for those folks in need.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
The title is self-sufficiency, but everything that I'm hearing is that it's about subsidies. Is there a relationship between the subsidies and a goal of helping people become self-sufficient?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, absolutely. In fact, our measurements that we are required for our blanket federal funding stream, which is Community Service Block Grant, requires us to meet six national goals through our community action partners. The first national goal is that to assist people in becoming self-sufficient. Most of our funds are married to case management, and case management is to move people to self-sufficiency by gaining the skills necessary to either find employment, find permanent housing, help them with discretionary income. In other words, if they're paying more than 30% of their income for their housing, that there doesn't leave a lot of dollars for any of their other needs. So one of the programs we particularly are proud of is the Tenant Readiness Program, which is training to give people the skills to find housing, budgeting skills, and most of our community action agencies do have that kind of training available, and we certainly encourage that.
Senator Johnson.
Perhaps to ask Representative Richardson's question a slightly different way, and you may get to it as your presentation unfolds, but in reading from the rental assistance programs, you talk about the tenant readiness program and life training skills, and what I don't see on the other side when I'm trying to look at the key output, you talk about persons served, but I don't know what the results are. Do you measure how many people went through your program and then were able to go on and be successful renters independently based on the skills they received from your training program? Do you track recidivism, that's the wrong word, but repeat users back through your program? This is just gross population served. I don't correlate that with results.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, yes, those are the key output measurements, but if you look down to performance measurements and the homelessness prevention is a performance measurement, we do have the results-oriented management and accountability known as ROMA that is also a requirement of a reporting requirement that tells us as a part of those six national goals what are the indicators that that community action agency is measuring And they do measure things such as how long someone has maintained permanent housing, how long that individual and how many individuals have maintained employment. As a part of their involvement with the wraparound case management and community action. And I would be happy to provide you with the actual measurements. We do measure annually. In some programs, we measure quarterly, but we do measure annually for our funding streams.
I'd love to see it, Mr. Chair. If you let me follow up, just picking one, transitional housing assistance measurement, total number of individuals provided with traditional housing opportunities in 2004, 1,266. Out of that population of 1,266, can you extrapolate from your data the number of people who then used that and went on to be able to be successful tenants somewhere?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, our measurements in the homeless management are improving as we speak. But we can tell you, and we can provide unduplicated counts of people who are moving from transitional housing or homelessness into permanent housing.
That'd be great.
It is less scientific to be able to track them if they fail and what happens, because some of them just fall off of the map as far as community action agencies. But we are gaining in our ability, and we are developing a homeless management information system that will try and capture just exactly that kind of information. But what we do have now, I would be absolutely thrilled to bring to the committee.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you track, do you have a metric for subscription, either over or under, with respect to resources that you have available for assistance? Particularly interested in, to the extent that we're oversubscribed. You have people, I mean, do we have 10,000 people trying to get into 1,000 opportunities, or do you track any of those statistics?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, we do have... For example, in the one-night shelter count, we have the number of turnaways, and we turn to our community action partners to tell us really the level of the folks in their community that they have been unable to serve that come in and seek assistance. We do know that, for example, in our energy programs, we know the number of eligible people within the state of Oregon eligible to receive assistance, and the number that we are actually serving is about 22%. So in that case, that is a good indication that the lack of more dollars, or with more dollars we would serve more individuals, mm-hmm. that there are a number of eligible people who are going unserved.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Colleagues, I guess I've been guilty because I've had to run and take care of a legislative issue, and so I've been gone. But we have a big packet to get through, and on Friday I intend to report to the co-chairs and the vice chair that we're on schedule. And so we truly need to get moving forward. If we have real necessary questions, perhaps between now and the next couple of days, I can schedule a block of time where folks can come and join myself and Director Repine in asking questions. But we really do need to move forward.
Mr. Chair, would it be your pleasure, then I would just touch briefly on our community capacity building programs. I mentioned the Community Service Block Grant, CSBG, which is dedicated federal funding for community action activities. And it really is a very flexible dollar that comes into the state to community action agencies that allows them to really better administer their programs that may not have the necessary funds available and tied to the other programs for administrative and overhead expense. One of the other capacity building programs that we have that I will touch on very briefly is the Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations Program that was the former ombudsman program. We have trained mediators that work in the community as well as working through community-based organizations to provide mediation in landlord-tenant disputes within parks. and that is a very successful program. We do survey those folks that utilize the program and have been really pleased that we believe that it does save on court costs and keeps people in an affordable housing situation. And there is a whole lot more to say about that particular program, but recognizing the shortness of time, I will turn it over to my colleague, Bob Gillespie.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Gillespie. I'm the administrator of the Housing Division, and I'll pick up a couple programs that are left from the Community Capacity Building and highlight those, and then I'll jump into the affordable housing and rental programs. One program that's activity that's listed here is the Home Community Development Corporation. This is a group of funds that's called the Home Investment Partnership Act that we actually get from HUD. We get, by a format basis, we can use a certain percentage of these funds to help support the operations of community development corporations around the state. We actually have $295,000 in those funds that we use to support organizations, and we marry those with funds from the Neighborhood Partnership Fund, which is a statewide nonprofit that supports community development organizations, as well as the Enterprise Foundation, which is a national nonprofit. And combined, we have about $595,000 in funds of their funds and ours that we use to help support organizations that do community development, and particularly in manners that help maintain their effectiveness in what they're doing. The second program in this area that we have is the Community Incentive Fund Program. This came out of the 2001 legislative session as part of Governor Kitzhaber's Livability Initiative. It was designed to get a jobs housing balance in the core areas of cities, as well as revitalizing the urban cores. In 2001, DAS sold $20 million of lottery-backed bonds. We've used $14.5 million of those to fund 66 projects, and as you can see in the bottom of page 20, we got pretty good leverage out of those programs. For every dollar of incentive fund that we sold, we got $826 in other dollars in 2003 and $1053 in dollars in 2004. And we've done really good projects with this, projects like in Oakland, where there isn't a vacant school in the city of Oakland on the east end of Main Street. They rehabilitated the building. It became a community center and a senior center, and it added, you know, life to the east end of the Main Street of downtown Oakland. And in this program, where Mr. Refine was talking about working with the regional field representatives, this is clearly a case where the regional field representatives worked with the cities to help identify the projects that we'd use the incentive funds for. The last community capacity building program is regional housing centers. Our department has a large number of single-family programs, from homeownership education to single-family loans to rehabilitation to emergency repair loans and then weatherization. And what we didn't have was a good delivery mechanism for the citizens of Oregon to go to one place to find out how they could access these funds. So what we've done is we've created 9 regional housing centers around the state, and we'll continue to develop some more until we have the whole state covered. And this way, a person that wants to get their house rehabilitated with the community development block rehab funds can also get their home weatherized at the same time. And the regional housing center serves as a conduit to go to the different agencies that actually can make it one point of contact, but might be multiple agencies doing the work. So that was the balance of the community capacity building. I've switched to the on page 23, the homeownership and affordable rental housing programs. And as you can see on page 23, there's a whole lot of activities under this. We have a lot of programs. So in the essence of time, I'll lump them into 3 main categories. And one would be single-family activities. Another one would be multifamily loans. And then the third one would be multifamily subsidies, either in rents or grants or tax incentives. The first one, the residential loan program, or the single-family activities, is driven by the residential loan program. We've talked a little bit about that earlier. We use tax-exempt bond proceeds to make loans throughout the state. We have about 400 lenders around the state that participate in this program with different banks around the state. They're, as we said earlier, they're the ones making the loans, and then we actually purchase these loans. Most of the loans are for first-time home buyers. There are some areas of the state where there's an exception to that, but in most instances, they're first-time homeowners. Most of the loans are insured, either by FHA, rural development, or private insurance. And generally speaking, our loans are about three-quarters of a point below the market at any given time. If you look on page, on the top of page 24.
Two quick questions.
Yes.
One is, when did this begin?
You know,
76.
I think so. It's one of the longest standing programs.
Back at that time in 76, the rental rates were between like 11 and 13%. And so we're now down at 4 or 5%. Are you saying that there is no floor on this? I mean, it's always going to be less no matter how low the rates are in the marketplace.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rich, well, you're the chair now. Mr. Chair, sorry. Our ability to keep the rates low is dependent on what we can actually sell the bonds for. So there's a correlation as the rental or the market drops in the interest rates, so do our bonds on a corresponding level.
I can see the relationship. Thank you.
Okay. Anyway, on the top of page 24, I was going to point out the amount of production that we have done in the single-family loan program. You can see in 2000, we actually made 1,860 loans, and then by the time we got to 2004, we're down to 1,051. So our production is actually dropping. I think there's several reasons for that. One that you've kind of indicated, that the market was compressing and the interest rates. So the relative value of our loan in comparison to the market, even though we're still three-quarters of a point below, when the market interest rates are low, our product isn't as advantageous. And then we also found that in the private sector, there was a good deal of down payment assistance with the financing. You can get all kinds of options now. And so for affordable housing, we went and developed a product that begins to match that with something called premium bonds. We sell a portion of the bonds at a higher rate and enables us to give some down payment assistance to lower-income households to help them with the financing of their homes. And with those premium bonds, we have what's called the Cash Advantage Program. And with about half of our loans now, we have 3% down payment assistance to go along with the financing, and then they pay about a half percent interest rate higher than the regular loans that we would have had. And with that, our production is jumping. In the last, the figures on the top of 24 stopped on June 30th of last year. In the last half of last year, we actually did another 893 single-family loans. The performance measures for the single-family... Wait a minute. I want to make sure I'm on the right ones. Yeah, the performance measures for the single-family loans start on page 24 and actually go to page 25. I had an extra page in my book, and it's confusing me because I went from 24 to 23. Anyway, what we're measuring in these performance measures is the extent to which our loans are going to lower-income households. And the first performance measure, the one that's on page 24 in the middle of the page there, we wanted 100% of our loans to households that are 100% of area median income and below, and we succeeded with that. If you look at 2004 and the next one down, we wanted 85% of our loans to be with households that are 90% of median income or less. We actually got 95% of our loans there. And then the top of page 25, we're looking about the number of loans that we made to households that were at 80% of median income, and we targeted 70%, but we actually hit 84% of our loans were to households that were at or below area median, 80% of area median income.
Senator Carter.
Thank you. It's actually, I'm masquerading as Senator Carter.
Okay.
Do you have the absolute numbers that accompany these percentages?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I do. They vary by county. I could get those for you, and it also varies by household size as well. But you're talking about the percent of median income by a household size.
Well, any of these key performance measures that you have rendered as percentages, just as a sample, I'd like to see the absolute numbers underlying it.
I understand.
That's one of the questions, excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
That's one of the questions we were trying to clarify the other day in our meeting, because we needed the raw data, you know, to tell us you have 100% and in terms of your reaching your goal, but does that mean you had 5,000 people in the program, and of the 5,000 people, how many really did get this housing, and what's the retention rate, and that kind of stuff?
That's what I'm driving at. I'd like to know, what does 100% mean, 5,500?
And with 50? Median income level, I mean, the data would be helpful.
Yeah.
If you could provide that to our committee, please.
We knew you did.
You want it.
We also have, moving on, we'll get that information for you.
Thanks.
And we have companion single-family programs with Habitat for Humanity around the state. We had $500,000 in our loan program that we set aside at 0% interest rate to help those affiliates increase their production. I mentioned the housing rehabilitation program in conjunction with the regional housing centers. That's funded with community development block grant. Those are HUD funds, and we have $4.2 million of those. We also have another down payment program called American Dream Down Payment Initiative Program. That's an adjunct to the home program that we got last year, and that will augment our down payment assistance that we have with the premium bond programs to the tune of about $887,000. And then finally, we have a program called the Homeownership Assistance Program in the single family activities. And with this, we do three different activities. One is we have down payment assistance that we run through the Oregon Mortgage Brokers Association, Oregon Bankers Association. And with this, we take of these funds, we give them $1,500 to a household, and then they match that, at least have to match that funds, if not do greater. And typically the match is about 6-1, but they're providing down payment assistance to lower income Oregonians for first time home ownership. And they do that for us at no administrative fee. So we find that to be a very good program. The HOPE funds also help support the housing centers and help support the home ownership training program that we have around the state. And that called the ABCs of Home Buying and the Home Ownership Education Collaborative. And if you look on the top of page 25, I'm losing my place. I'm sorry. Yeah, it's on page 25, but it's the second performance measure down. And again, this isn't in absolute numbers. It's in percentages. But we could get that for you if you like. This is talking about the number of households that we make loans to that are that have completed the ABCs of Home Buying, which is the statewide training curriculum on home ownership. And it's, you know, statistically, if lower income households that are going into home ownership have the ABC or a home buyer education training program, they have a greater likelihood of success in the long run. And our goal is to hit 20% of our loans to being households that have completed this curriculum. At present, we've gotten to 15%, where we started at 3% in 2000. I think there's also other programs that are being offered, like with the Portland Housing Center, that we might do ourselves a service if we also looked at their companion curriculum instead of just focusing strictly on the ABCs of home buying. Switching from the single family to the multifamily loans, the second group, these programs are also financed with low-income bonds proceeds that we do below market interest rate loans. We have three basic programs. We have the risk share program that does a lot of family housing, and risk share is a program that we do in combination with HUD, as the name describes, that we're actually sharing the risk on the credit enhancement or the mortgage insurance with HUD on a 50-50 basis. We have the elderly and disabled loan program that does independent apartments for elderly. It can also do assisted living facilities and group homes. Currently, there's a moratorium on assisted living facilities, so that program isn't as active as it has been.
I'm gonna interject here and ask if you could wrap your section up in the next 3 to 5 minutes.
I can.
Okay, perfect.
And
we're moving on.
And I can do it real easily. Okay. And then we created a conduit program, which is where we're actually giving our tax-exempt authority to other individuals. And that's the three basic programs that we have in the multifamily loan section. And the performance measure for the multifamily loan is that we wanted to see that we were making 88% of our loans to households at 60% of area median income or less. And we have successfully exceeded that in every year. Real briefly, I want to mention that we went this last year, because of last legislative session, we gained the authority to do interest rate swaps, which is a new program that we have. We're the first public agency to have done an interest rate swap on a project in Eugene. And that's a good product for our partners that it reduces the carrying costs as well as reducing the interest rate. And then the last area is the grants and tax incentives. And there's a group of key programs here. We have the low-income housing tax credits. That's a program that's authorized by the IRS that gives us about $58 million in equity that we can use annually for affordable housing projects. The second largest one in this division is the HOME program, the Home Investment Partnership Program. That is HUD dollars. And we get about $10.4 million annually. And we use that for multiple purposes, but including multifamily finance. And most of our projects use a combination of these. And so you have a program that's IRS and you have a program that's HUD. So the folks that are actually doing this are brave people to actually work with those type of regulations. I'm talking about our partners. We utilize the Housing Trust Fund from the state that is great for the partners to help them meet their goals and objectives of getting those other funds. And the state's Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is a great tool, particularly for targeting rents to special needs and lower income populations. The state tax credit program works in a manner where the lender gets a credit for making the loan at an interest rate that's 4% lower. And then the savings from that reduced interest rate have to be passed on to the tenants 100% in lower rents. And that's a program I think that's unique to the state. And we have, I'm getting the hurry up time. We do this through a consolidated funding cycle that's done twice a year. And then our performance measures, if you look on page 26, and I'll let you read these later on, but the grants and tax incentives, what we're really trying to do is to deep skew it, because this is money that doesn't have to be paid back. And if you'll look at the different performance measures, you'll see that we're exceeding our performance measures and serving very low-income households. And with that, I'll stop.
Thank you very much. That's a lot of information.
Talk real fast.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I would invite Kathleen Joy up to the table for the last piece of our overview. Kathleen Joy is the Executive Director of the Commission on Voluntary Action and Service for the state, and Bob mentioned it that she joined our agency two sessions ago, or her organization did. I am going to cover program outreach and accountability, and I will just be very, very brief on this. It's on page 28 and 29 of your packet. Essentially, I've already mentioned the high standard that the department is required to maintain relative to the Internal Revenue Code, the Security and Exchange Commission, when it comes to issuing bonds and tax credits. The good news is you never hear about us, because we are doing the job that we need to be doing. Within this unit is our financial operations unit, financial management division. They are highly regarded. When I came to the department as the CFO, I thought this was the best financial unit in the state. They're mentioned in the Moody's. One reason why we have a good bond rating, they say, is the strong financial management team, and they're strong and color-coordinated today. They do an excellent job. In addition to that, our IS unit, we have really come a long way in the last several years in our information services division, so I'll just touch on it briefly that the OPUS project we reported to the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management Technology a couple months ago. This project, long time coming, allowing us to deliver to you and the policymakers and citizens of the state better information on our anti-poverty self-sufficiency programs. We had never had that before. We had tried it in a number of different ways, but the web-based applications, we have donated computers to partners, helped people in remote areas of the state get internet access, and anytime I'm traveling to Pendleton, Ontario, Southern Oregon, they are raving about it. Because we do have 64 separate programs, and there was always a reporting requirement to the feds this quarter, that federal fiscal year, then a state fiscal year. They have all the information in a database now. There's pre-programmed reports. So, this agency has come a long way. Similarly, and I'll just touch on this, another brag story here. We are adding constantly new units of affordable housing in our portfolio and not nearly adding the staff commensurate with that in the Asset and Property Management Division. We have used technology through handheld asset and property management devices. So we are way, way innovative through this particular division. Very proud. I'm proud to say I work for government when I'm associated with people like this. And with that, I'll turn it over to Kathleen Joy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I extend the regrets of your former colleague, Ralph Brown, who's our commission chair. He and I are planning to meet with you all at a later date. I've given you a handout which gives an overview of who we are and what we are, and I don't intend to read it to you. I do want to focus a minute on our three programming areas, remembering that this is a commission that currently has 18 members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate to ensure that volunteerism and community service happen in Oregon communities. Our three programs are AmeriCorps, volunteerism, and civic engagement. I want to report that in AmeriCorps, when we came in 2001 during the chair's early time in this committee, we were only serving, AmeriCorps was only represented in about 16 counties. Through a concerted effort, we now have all but one program in our portfolio serving a total of 30 Oregon counties. We've gone to a total intermediary system in which small community-based organizations can access an AmeriCorps resource to meet a need of their choosing. And I've included in there is a list of all the programs that we currently sponsor. We've done a wonderful job even at a time in the program year 2003-2004. We had bad cutbacks in numbers of AmeriCorps volunteers due to some problems at the federal level, but with fewer members, we still generated more community volunteers to work with them. So there's a lot of good news coming out of AmeriCorps, and we can happily share more of that with you when we meet with you individually. Our second programming area, which really began with the 2001 session when our legislation gave us some responsibility and authority to work on the benchmark 30, the number of Oregonians involved in service, gave us the legislative authority to move forward with the creation of the Oregon State Plan for Volunteerism. Out of that has come an official Oregon State Committee on Volunteerism, which almost staffed through an application process. It involves representatives of volunteer organizations from throughout the state, includes representatives from each of the regional volunteer managers association and each of the four volunteer centers in the state. We have a website now, OregonVolunteers.org, which provides access to means for local citizens to find local volunteer opportunities in their communities, and provides information and resources for volunteer managers. We just finished our first statewide train-the-trainer for 31 representatives of community-based organizations so that they can go back to their communities and train other volunteer managers on successfully supporting community volunteers. The underlying thrust for us is that it's one thing to have a community volunteer, but it's another thing to have an infrastructure to support those community volunteers so that their volunteer experience is successful. And that's what we heard from people across the state that they wanted, and that's what we're attempting to provide to them, not as new players on the block, but by working with existing organizations and help building local structures that can provide that support. I'll watch your mailbox soon for information on our first statewide recognition effort that we're working with the Office of the Governor on right now, and probably a year from now our first real conference on volunteerism. The last area we came into just about a year ago, civic engagement, which has been a cornerstone of member development for AmeriCorps members since we were founded in 1994. But at our strategic planning retreat a year ago, commissioners decided that this was an area where we could actually do some direct programming, always looking for some sustainability. We are only in this budget as federal funds for this year. We hope to be back and see you later in a different frame of mind and financial status for the state. We have worked with, we are currently working with Senator Deckert and Representative Galto on some discussions about civic education for students. We developed a partnership with the Secretary of State's office to implement Title V of the Help Americans Vote Act. That didn't quite get to come to fruition. This year they did some pilots with without using college students, which was the impetus behind Title V, but we are still planning to work with them for the next election cycle. And we did a wonderful civic engagement training for 450 AmeriCorps members in Vistas, tying the Bill of Rights to historical events that brought history to life for all these AmeriCorps members and helped them understand the voice of the citizen in reaching back out to their communities. So those are accomplishments. You've got specific data on the 8 programs in our AmeriCorps portfolio highlights, and I've attached the complete reports of highlights. It's very hard for me to tell you, Senator Johnson, whether those students that were tutored improved their reading because of AmeriCorps. It's the very tough thing about working where you're placing citizen volunteers out in communities to break out, whether it was the new reading curriculum that the school chose, the tutoring that the AmeriCorps member did, the extra work that happened in the classroom because of the parent volunteer that came in because the AmeriCorps volunteer recruited them. So we are continuing to struggle with how we measure that impact beyond the number. In some places, we are a little more successful than others. You will see more numbers that are midpoints instead of interims because of the complexity of providing extra hands to a variety of agencies and organizations that are using those hands to meet the needs that they identify as the most specific. So that's my very quick overview, Mr. Chair.
Well, you're good. That was very good and concise. Any questions? Can you explain how I'm looking at the federal funds that come into the state.
Uh-huh.
And it looks like there's about $5.5 million.
That's correct.
Does the commission then grant those dollars out to entities?
About 4.8 goes back out to entities. For AmeriCorps programs, that's correct. And part of those funds, the AmeriCorps funding is split into two piles. 25% goes to national organizations that operate in more than one state, and 75% goes to states for commissions like ours to administer. We're in a formula like many federal programs, so we have about $1 million a year that we get to grant directly. Then they have a little pool that's put aside for programs that operate only in one state but are very competitive, great programs. So that's how you build a portfolio. We currently have another $1.5 million in programming coming into only Oregon programs, and that's actually all organizations that are associated with state agencies. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission, Aspire program, has over 51 members working around the state.
How far did you have to travel to get here today?
Just from Portland.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's not travel.
No, I don't think so either.
Would it be possible to get a list of the different services that have been provided? I'd like to see the outreach that has occurred.
Okay.
I think this is a really neat project or program.
It's really grown since we came to see you first in 2001, I think.
And I'd like to just see the outreach that's gone on around the state.
Absolutely. And we will also inform you, we are doing, all of our AmeriCorps programs that work statewide are doing a consolidated outreach effort to communities this year. And we'll also be bringing AmeriCorps members back on March 16th for AmeriCorps Day at the Capitol, and they can talk to you then.
Representative Richardson.
I'm wondering if you could provide me with information on the HIPAA program, Oregon Instruction for Parents of Preschool Youngsters.
That is a national direct program. That's a program that operates in multiple states and then subgrants into Oregon. That money comes into the Oregon Child Development Corporation, which works predominantly with migrant workers. That program is administered through the Oregon Child Development Corporation and works in Washington County. It takes low income, and in this case, I believe all the members are Hispanic, English as a second language speakers, who then are trained to work with other members of their community to help their preschool children get ready to go to school. So it's a parent-teaching parent program.
Any other questions? Well, I'm looking at our agenda for today, and we went through a lot of information at about a 50,000-foot level very quickly, but I think we were able to get a flavor of what the Housing and Community Services Department is about. You all have your information, and I would encourage you to continue to read through. And then tomorrow we're going to move into the prioritization list and the 10% reduction options. So we're moving quick. These vice chairs and co-chairs, they have high expectations of getting this through, and we'll have more time between now and the end of the session to further discuss these issues. And again, we'll be setting up a time to work with Director Repine, and if any of you have questions or want to pursue issues further, that'll be an opportunity to move forward on those. So with that, I think we are going to be adjourned for the day. Thank you very much.
Oh.